Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to The Mentor. I'm Mark Burris. Now today my guest, he's been a guest of mine before, is Dean Jones. He's the co-founder and CEO of fashion rental business Glam Corner. They started in 2012 renting high-end ball gowns for a fraction of the price that they would normally sell for. They've grown to thousands and thousands of users, and they're very, very popular. And in the last 6 months, Glam Corner has now launched a subscription service. Customers pay a monthly fee to get sent 3 items of clothing that they can return and swap at any time throughout the month. It sounds like a great way to update your wardrobe without adding to what you throw away and for a much cheaper price. And by the way, it is environmentally friendly when you consider how much clothing gets dumped in this country every year. I have met Dean before, as I said, and he was a guest on one of the pitch episodes of my podcast nearly 3 years ago. And the Glam Corner business has now grown. I'm really happy to see how much it's grown, and it's changed so much, I just can't wait to dig into it further. So let's get into it. Dean Jones, welcome to The Mentor.
Mark, mate, thanks for having me. It's good to be back.
We won't call The Mentor then, I don't think that.
No, I think it was an earlier version.
The Mark Burris Show in those days.
That's it.
Righto, mate. Glam Corner.
That's us.
Tell me about it. How did you get started? What's the deal? You and your wife?
Absolutely. Yeah. So my wife, Audrey, and I founded this business about 6-7 years ago when we realized that the average Australian woman really only wears about 1/3 of what's in her wardrobe. The other 2/3 is this kind of stockpile of items that she had purchased for a single event and then never wore it again, which was, to us, it just seemed like a really bad deal. And so we looked around and we're thinking and saw a lot of different businesses, particularly in the sharing economy, that were solving this exact problem in different ways, you know, ride sharing, house sharing, streaming your music, and basically only paying for what you use. And we said, well, you know, why couldn't that apply to people's wardrobes as well? And so, yeah, the initial idea started with having a wardrobe that we thought if you let a certain amount of customers come in and share that wardrobe and only pay for what they use, that could solve a real problem for people.
Yeah, I like these sharing economies and sort of what you've really built as a, we're oversimplifying things here too to some extent, because clearly what you've had to do, if you have to work out how to go and buy what people want to wear, it's not just women, is it women or men as well?
It's women's only, it's women. Okay. Correct. Yeah.
So you've got to go and work out what women want to wear. So that means you've got to be a good buyer. Mm. So you've got to buy the stuff and then you've got to tell them what you've got. So you've got to build up a marketplace.
Yep.
So they can see what you've got. And then you've got to market to these individuals, and then you've got to deliver. The delivery part's probably not that difficult. So is this online, all online, or is it a physical outcome?
Purely online business, yep, direct.
Purely online. So tell me about first and foremost, what's your background?
So my background's in finance, so not in fashion. Same with my wife and co-founder, Audrey. She was from the financial planning industry.
Right, okay.
So we're not from the fashion industry.
Right.
It's funny though, the business, when you look at the balance sheet and the P&L, it's fundamentally an asset leasing business. So in terms of merchandising, we run it the same way. You've got to buy the right assets. You've got to make sure they're going to last a long time. That merchandising function has gotten increasingly more data driven as well, making sure we're buying what customers are looking for and taking a lot of the guesswork out of that part of the fashion cycle, which is great for us as a business, also fantastic for the end consumer.
Yeah, so like, you're right. You've actually built a leasing business. you know, it's no different to leasing cars or tractors or whatever else. People lease, you know, desks. I mean, you can lease all sorts of things these days to operate in a business. And each of these individuals that who are your subscribers and or customers, basically part of their plant and equipment or their inventory is what they wear to work.
Exactly.
For example, most of us work every day. So a lot of the clothes you're working, you're renting are work clothes, are they?
Yeah, exactly.
As well as, you know, other stuff.
Eventsy stuff, birthdays, the seventh wedding you got to go to this year.
Yeah.
Anywhere we can remove the burden of ownership for our customer and allow her to be a bit more now adventurous with her style, because instead of buying for work kind of blacks and greys and khakis, which are a good value if you know you're going to use them a lot, now that we've removed that burden of ownership, suddenly we're seeing a lot more bright colours, prints and other styles that actually allows our customer to, you know, really, really kind of find her personal style.
So what happens, like, I want to go back and talk to you about you in a moment, but I'm just curious. So what happens, let's say I'm a female and I get on there and I buy whatever it is, something bright. I rent it, I should say, and do I wash it? And do I have it for a month or...
Yeah.
How's it work?
So we wash everything. So we can ship everything to customers and back within 24 hours.
You can only wear it once?
Oh, when you've got it on subscription, you can wear it as much as you like. But we insist, look, let us wash it. We're better at it. If you want to have it washed, send it back to us. We'll send you something new.
Right.
We actually have had to build our own in-house laundromat. We're cleaning about 30 tons a month. It's a good size laundromat. It's a full wet care facility that can, you know, it's very environmentally friendly and takes really good care of the garments. So yeah, there's no burden of having to wash it. All the bad parts about owning clothing, we're trying to take that away from customers.
So effectively, I go on there and I rent a colourful dress and I wear it tomorrow afternoon to either a cocktail party or wear it to the office, whatever I decide to do, and then I just put it back in a bag and a box, whatever it is, and I send it back to you.
Exactly, it comes with a prepaid return satchel. You just put it in the post box.
Yeah. So and that's it. I don't even have to think about it. So basically, just drop it on the floor.
Spotify for your wardrobe.
So it's like the old, I don't know if everyone probably remembers it, when I was 18 or 19, I might have had to go to a formal. I went and rented a suit, dinner suit, and what was it? Well, I can't remember what those things were called. Then get your after darker from someone, Parker. There was used to be an old saying, Gary Parker.
Got a ring to it.
Get your after darker from Brett Parker. That's what it was. Get your after darker from Brett Parker. Brett Parker was a dinner suit hire company. And of course, you know, we couldn't afford to buy a dinner suit, and we'd never buy them because you don't ever wear it once in your life. Mm. I soon remember lots of blokes used to vomit on these things, etc. But so of course it was usually the first formal you ever went to when you were 18, 19, and the first time you ever really drank a lot. Get your after darker from Brett Parker. I remember that. That's cool. Yeah. So I got the general gist of it. We'll get into more into detail a bit later and how all the various parts or functions of your business work. But I think for people listening to this, we need to go back a few steps and ask you, Dean. But you know, people like to know, wow, here's a guy who's with a financial planning background, is now running a business. So take me back to when you were a kid. What is it, do you think, that initiated your sense of being creative and going and getting involved in these businesses? Was it your family? Was it your education? Or was it your schooling? Or is it stamped on your DNA? Or what is it? How does it work? What did you look like? What did Dean look like when he was, say, 15 or 16?
Yeah, well, he didn't look very good. That's why he didn't have a girlfriend. But I think it's a really deep question, Mark. I think what kind of...
Dive in, mate.
Yeah, what kind of bred a sense in me to kind of give it a crack? And if you see an opportunity, to take it.
Mm.
I think I'm lucky, you know... Yeah, I've come from a pretty working class family. My mother was a nurse, which is some of the hardest working people on the planet. So any nurses out there, anyone who knows a nurse needs to know they're a very special person.
Mm.
And then to my dad, who built his own business, which is a software business from the ground up as well. And I saw firsthand how hard that is and how long it takes. You know, it takes 10 years to build an overnight success. And I feel like for my dad, I felt like 20. So I saw that. And I think from an early age that bred quite a good sense of work ethic, you know, into me. I think from when I was young, actually 14, 15 is when I started looking for like weekend jobs or school holiday jobs just to try.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Hurstville, which is Southwest Sydney.
Yep.
And I think you grew up in Bankstown, something in that area?
Not far from us. Well, I went to school in Bankstown, but I was more near an area called Ngawi.
Oh, yeah, I know Ngawi really well.
Ngawi, Riverwood.
Yeah, well, Penshurst. I say Hurstville. I actually grew up in Penshurst, so yeah, I know Ngawi really well. I think over time, just the idea that, you know, money doesn't grow on trees and you've got to go out and earn it yourself, at least... I think didn't necessarily breed a sense of ambition per se.
Were you ambitious?
Yeah, I think early on, I think I just wanted to find, you know, I was always eager to learn, try new things. I think that's the kind of fundamentals of ambition, a good ambition in a lot of ways, is try something different, and try to have an impact if you can. Because those opportunities, don't always come up. I think that sense of just being grateful, I think, as well, and humble is a really important piece, because Audrey and I are the first people to admit, you know, these people from a finance background, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to change an industry they were never a part of, we're the first people to admit this may be the only chance in our lives to take a swing this big. Mm. So we're giving everything we can and being realistic about that, because, you know, those opportunities don't land in your lap every day.
Yeah. Well, and by the way, I'm going to apologise to our listeners in advance. I'm as sick as a dog, and I've had that, you know, that maybe too much detail with the D's and V's or not, but I'm trying to keep energised for this because I find this very interesting. And as usual, the show must go on. You've got to turn up to these fucking things. You know, if you want to put yourself out there, you've got to turn up. And Dean was good enough to get in here today, so I'm here. So I'm going to drink my coffee slowly so I don't do a big puke all over the table.
Go for it, mate.
Yeah. No, I don't normally go for it. So, and as I said earlier, I have met Dean a long, long time ago on the old Mark Boris show, which is the precursor to this show, which is where we were just trying to build up this podcast. And it's interesting to see where Dean's at today, Dean Audrey, where they are at today. So... but I guess what I really need to know, Dean, and maybe it could have been Audrey for that matter, but she's not here to talk about it. She's sick too, isn't she?
She is, actually. It's got the same thing as me. Exactly. I feel like it sounds like it's the same. Yeah, spread like wildfire.
Yeah, it's all over the shop. Yeah, I know. Everyone's getting it. I want to know from you, Dean, like, where was that moment in your life that you think there was a sort of a switch from being a kid growing up in Penshurst, going to school, probably watching a bit of footy, hanging out with your friends, probably enrolled to do some sort of course to become a financial planner, and then you just decided, shit, I can do this. Mm. When was that? I mean, yeah. Do you remember it?
You know what? I don't remember a specific one, but I think as you kind of described, there's perhaps a series of moments that can accumulate where it starts to become second nature, perhaps. I was very lucky when I think about it. I remember my nan had told me that there was a scholarship test for a school in the eastern suburbs. And hey, give it a crack. You know, I'm a smart enough kid. Try it out. And so I said, sure, Nan, sounds like a good idea. And so I did that and I actually got it. So I got a scholarship to a school in the eastern suburbs. And I had to travel a long way to school every day. But I think that perhaps that one moment showed me how you can do it. If you give it a crack, had you not gone and tried it, you would have never known. And then I think being at that school, to keep that scholarship, you've got to keep your grades up. So I think that also created a sense of urgency in me that, you know.
Yeah, pressure to compete.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, just don't fuck it up.
Yeah, totally. So, I guess what you're saying is that at some stage or other, you looked back. If you look back today, you can see that there was occasions where if you took a risk and you did something you thought you could do and just had a crack, that it would be successful. But in terms of this business, you didn't sort of think that for this business. I mean, where was the light? When did the light turn on that you and Audrey sitting there and you thought, yeah, let's have a go at this? Did you leave a job to do this?
Not initially. I mean, kept my job because I had to keep paying the bills.
Yep.
Within a year, Audrey was able to at least. And
how old were you?
So we were 25, 26,
right.
mid-20s. That part of our lives when we actually were that customer, Audrey especially, kept having to buy a new item for every occasion because there's kind of social pressure to do so. But I think the light bulb moment for us is when we're thinking about doing the business and we asked people we knew, have you ever borrowed clothing? Do you ever share clothing to solve this kind of problem?
Well, I don't know, sure, but I think girls do that anyway.
That was the overwhelming answer. Yeah. Like, our customer has been sharing clothing her entire life with her close friends and family. But kind of like how Uber didn't invent ride sharing or carpooling. It's been around a long time. Mm. They just introduced a technology to allow that community to come together and really act as a lubricant to that behavior. So we realized the same. It's like, well, if this behavior is already there, it's an underlying thing. What if you just created a platform that allowed people to do it more? Maybe you could create a business out of it.
And had a broader depth of things, inventory, a broader depth of inventory and made it much more accessible and more affordable and probably more interesting too, and not so specialised like the old Brett Parker days when you used to buy your rent your After Darker from Brett Parker.
He was onto something. It's good.
No, I remember that when I was a kid growing up too. That, you know, you 18, 19 year old, you rented your dinner suit from Brett Parker. So you and Audrey, was it you or Audrey thought of the idea?
It was absolutely Audrey. Yeah. She should absolutely be taking full credit for that.
Yeah. So one morning she woke up and she said to you, "Hey Dean, why don't we set up this structure and start to pump these items of clothing out to all our friends?" So was it just friends in the beginning, or how'd you work it?
Well, it began with her wardrobe being crammed full of things she never used, and she was getting sick of that. In fact, it was starting to impose on my life, starting to fill up space in my wardrobe too.
Yeah.
You know, so suddenly we said, look, we should give this a crack. And that's where it did start. Started in our house. We set up in our little study room, a rack full of clothing, and on a Facebook page, didn't even have a website yet, started inviting friends and family to just try it out. Trying to convince people to pay for it too, that was really important. You give something away for free, you know, most of the time, if it's good, people will take it.
Yeah.
We had to try to figure out where does the pricing land and how does the economics of it land.
Were you selling it or?
No, we were renting it from the very beginning.
What did you say, here's a red dress, buck for the night?
Yeah. No, so here's a red dress, we bought it for $800. Could we rent it to you for $100?
For the night or for the week?
For four days. How long do you need it for? It turned out to be 5 days, which we've since been able to narrow to 4 days because it's an asset utilization piece.
Yeah.
An extra day adds up throughout a 12, 18-month period.
Yeah. And do you work on some sort of matrix to say that this item will should last us 10 wears and 10 washes? And do you work out the mathematics of it? In other words, that you get your $800 back plus a return?
Exactly. Yeah. It has to earn its cost of capital within about 90 days.
Right.
Which for an asset leasing business is pretty damn good. And it can last 12, 18 months. So we know on a field of kind of, you know, lines of ROI, we know within a month if something is on track to perform, outperform or underperform. And from there, we decide to buy more of it or to sell it off and recycle that capital into better performing assets.
So Dean and Audrey were sitting down. They probably didn't realise that they got a tiger by the tail. So at what point did you realise you had a business?
Yeah, I think we knew we had a business of a certain size within a few months, as in we saw people were really loving it. We realised that in Australia, at least, the logistics network was sophisticated enough. We could do this. We could send an item out, get to a customer, get it back pretty easily. It had a degree of scale kind of baked in. We knew that we could create a really nice second income, which in the early days it was. We built it up. We got the business profitable. It had gotten to a certain size. We were quite happy with it. But then it started around 2014, 2015. It really started to pick up steam. Maybe it was the sharing economy becoming more mainstream in everyone's lives. I'm not totally sure exactly what it was. Or maybe I think also we were a direct beneficiary of just the online retailing boom in general, I think was a good one.
That's what I call a rising tide. So, you know, like if you can get involved in a business that is in a rising tide, and the rising tide of online merchandising and sharing makes sense, and you're part of that rising tide.
Mm.
So if the closer you get to the beginning of the tide starting to rise, the better you do. So, there is a science at looking where the rising tides are, and this is one of them. And as you say, you know, like building websites became cheaper and easier and far more sophisticated. Delivery systems become much more reliable, and there's a pretty much a de rigueur, like a rigor in terms of what delivery companies are now expected to do in terms of time and quality delivery. They just don't throw the shit over the top of your fence. You know, there's a whole system built around that stuff. Mm. So they're all the rising tides that you and Audrey were able to take advantage of. Mm. You just had to make sure you knew about your customer. what your customer wanted in terms of the item.
Mm-hmm.
So who sat down and worked out how to build the website? Like, how did that all work? Because that's a critical part. That's your marketplace.
Yep.
Where people, you know, virtually walk in there and select what it is they want. I mean, if I'm looking for the red dress, is there a model in there with it on there? Or how's it all work?
Yeah, to begin with, as I said, we kind of began on this kind of Facebook page.
Yep.
And that's where it began. That's kind of at least told us in terms of merchandising what kind of products start to fly.
Tell me how you merchandise it on Facebook. What did you do?
Yeah, it was really hit and miss early on. But Audrey was the core customer, so I think that helped, as in she was not merchandising for herself per se, but she had had that problem so many times over the last 2 years. She had a good sense for what's the problem I'm solving for this customer? What kind of clothing is she buying and never getting full value out of? So they're the ones we started with. That's hit and miss though. I think early merchandising was like in the traditional sense, a bit of a scattergun, as in you line up a bunch of products, the ones that stick, you try to get back into faster.
Or anecdotal.
Yeah.
You're just saying, oh, that worked.
Exactly.
As opposed to sort of, yeah, not data driven, but it's sort of data driven. Yeah. You sort of say, oh, that worked, but it wasn't metrically measured.
And it was deliberate. I mean, at a small scale, that's the idea.
How many items did you start off on Facebook with? Like 50 items? Or
it was less. It was like 20.
20 items.
Yeah. And mainly floor length ball gowns, because that's a typical example.
Right.
You'll never wear it again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're not allowed to, because someone will remember that you wore that last time that they saw you. And they go, what the hell are you doing?
Like, oh, exactly.
Girls hate that shit.
Yeah. Exactly. And that's especially when Facebook and Instagram were starting to have that pressure on people's lives, that you especially now, your social circle wasn't just your immediate friends. It was 400 or 500 people you've met in the last few years who will notice. If you've worn the same thing,
you take one fucking photo, man, and it ends up a thousand people are going to look at it, and they're going to say, "I remember that dress."
Yeah.
So you started with a few items, and then what was the next big step? Like, I mean, I presume you guys funded this all yourselves
from
the beginning. Yep.
Pretty much every dollar we had.
Yeah. So you kept your day job.
Yeah, that's right.
And I keep saying to everybody, like, don't stop your day job until your side hustle starts to make enough money that you can quit your day job.
That's right.
And not many people get that. So you kept your day job, had your side hustle, kept building it up. At what point do you reckon you started to play into scale? In other words, maybe Audrey decided to leave her day job. Where was that?
It was probably about 6-12 months in when we noticed there was regular customers coming back within a month or so each time and starting to make that part of their wardrobe kind of outsourced to us. We said, wow, that is a big opportunity. And the growth lever becomes how big can the wardrobe get? Like any other asset leasing business, you know, a bank can only lend out technically so much that they have on the book in terms of deposits or wholesale money. So we said, wow, that's the same thing. So we started just incrementally add layers to the merchandising, more of those products. Experimentation, trying to find our ways into other lines. And that's what you need to have a certain amount of capital for. That's also where we were spending money, where some of it had a phenomenal return, some of it was a complete waste of money, but it was almost like that was part of the R&D of getting the formula right. That's money that had to be spent to calibrate. Otherwise, we were never going to get it there. And so as that found product market fit, I think within 6-12 months, that first stage of you rent an item, what does that product look like? What does the service look like? What does the pricing mechanics look like compared to retail? And that makes a lot of sense for people. So then it was about how do we get that in front of more customers?
How do you tell them?
Yeah.
You had to build up awareness. And where'd the name Glam Corner come from?
Yeah, I mean, early on, I think if you give too much time to a name, some people kind of think of a cool name and build a business around that. It was actually early feedback from customers too, because this initial Facebook page was not called that.
What was it called?
Oh, I think it was just kind of Dress Rental Sydney.
Right.
Dress Rental. It was something really generic, which would be very narrow now compared to what the business has evolved to. So I'm glad that didn't become the business name. Our customers kept saying back, consistent feedback was how many compliments they received and how glamorous they felt. And they never had a chance to feel that glamorous. We realized that's what we're renting that customer. We're renting her that feeling, even for a short amount of time. And Corner was just about destination. Like it was an online destination. It was a kind of a secret little corner of the internet where our customer could come and kind of find a life hack to her wardrobe. And so that's where Glam Corner kind of came together, and that's what stuck. And that's what our customer has built an affection for. You realize when a bunch of customers leave reviews, I love Glam Corner. They love the brand that they had rented, and they're like, that particular label was great, but I love Glam Corner for solving this for me. And we're like, wow, that's really striking a nerve in a really powerful way. So we knew we had something there. It's a name that people remembered. And so it stayed that way. And it's evolved. Thank you. Yeah.
It's a good name. It's a good name. Okay, well, we've got to go to the break because I've got to talk to my sponsors. But when we come back from the break, I want to talk to you. You just hit on something very important. Two things really important to me. You talked about your customers having affection for your brand. You talked about the next stage of building notoriety. And, of course, all great brands are built on notoriety and affection. So I want to talk to you about that. And the other thing you said that was very important was that when you were choosing the name, you worked out or you made the decision of why you're in business. In other words, you weren't renting out clothing items. You're giving people a sense of feeling glamorous. And so we want to get back to those because they're fundamentals. They're basics to me. And they're basics that most people who are listening to this need to identify up early in terms of their name and in terms of how they promote their business and in terms of what their business stands for. Okay, well, here we are. As usual, every week I sit down and I speak to our CEO from Mentor.Business. That's our business selling arm. We sell people's businesses and we help people buy business as well. And that's Matt Holland. And Matt is going to showcase one of the businesses that we have for sale this week. So, Matt, what do you got, mate?
Thanks, Mark. Got a bakery this week. It's just hit the market. It's a great opportunity for somebody to take over from a young couple that have built this from nothing. They purchased about 2 years ago. The business at that point was supplying into the wholesale supermarket chains. And then what they found was that it was really tough going because the supermarkets, basically, they won't pay for anything they don't use. So there was a lot of wastage and a lot of losses in this business. So what he's done is he's gone in there and he's turned it around and he's specialist. He's now a specialist in a particular boutique, you know, burger buns and hot dog buns and so on. And this guy's growing at 300%.
Wholesale?
He's wholesaler. Absolutely, all wholesale, no retail at all. He switched that off, and the best part about that is there's no early start, so he's actually got a later start, sleeps in the morning, and he works a little bit later in the evenings.
Oh, that's actually a good one, actually, in terms of not having to start early, because I once worked for a baker, and I used to have to start at like 2 in the morning, and I've always thought that's one of the worst parts of being a baker, having to get up so early. Mind you, you've got the whole day to do the rest of whatever you want to do, but you can't actually have a drink on Friday night because you've got to bake on Saturday usually. So, okay, so we've got a wholesale baker who specialises in wholesaling burger buns and hot dog buns and things like that. So obviously he's pretty bloody good at it. And what sort of money are we talking about? Is it affordable or are we above $1 million or below $1 million for the
sale
price?
We're below $1 million. And look, profits are growing. Now, this is something that's been growing month to month. So, you know, we really have to look at this business to see what it's been doing over the last 3 or 6 months rather than on a, you know, annual basis. But look, it's 300% growth per annum. He's making about $350,000 if we look at what he's doing right now in the last quarter. And as I said, most of his work is contracting, and he's supplying. His typical client would be a small to medium franchise, in that group. So he's not reliant on any particular business. He's got a good spread of clients. And just before I should have mentioned that he's not a baker. This guy is actually coming in from sales, so he has no baking experience. He's got a good team there, and he's real about social media, building up his...
Okay, so we've got a baker, wholesaling, making good bloody great money. He's not a baker, so you don't need to be a baker. You can be an investor in this business. Sydney, where is it? Where are we?
Sydney, Western Suburbs.
Sydney, West Suburbs. Sounds like a great business. It's a good one for sale. So if you've got a business for sale, come and talk to us at mentor.business, and in particular, come and talk to Matt, who's sitting right here opposite me. Or if you want to buy a business, come look on our website and have a look what we've got for sale. But this week, we are showcasing our baker in the Western Suburbs of Sydney, and it's a ripper. Thanks, guys. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks, Mark.
Okay, I'm back here with Dean Jones from Glam Corner, and unfortunately his wife and business partner can't be here because she got the same thing as me. Audrey, I wish you all the best. No doubt you'll be listening to this. What we talked about before the break was something really important to me. It's a fundamental. It's a non-negotiable. Dean said we worked out when we were going to give the business a name or change the name from whatever it was to Glam Corner was that the sense of... after doing research, and whether it's anecdotal or just listening to people, that they felt that moment of being glamorous. I need to understand that's your why. I mean, that's an important thing. It's not about money. It's not about ease of subscription. They're all little bits on the side. It's about people feeling glamorous. Whether they buy it or rent it, they still like to feel glamorous, in particular, and women in this case. How long did it take you to work out your purpose, your business's purpose?
Mm. It must have been... It has evolved, too, over time.
Yep.
It was definitely in that first 6 to 12 months where we weren't focused on building a business of a certain size. We were trying to figure out if we had a business idea at all and did it stick. The only way to do that was to, first of all, speak to our customers as much as we could. And we still try to do that as much as we can. And to calibrate offerings for that customer or think of ideas that maybe they haven't thought about yet. Because in that feedback loop, people tell you things, even if they don't tell you directly, you do hear things. When you think back to something someone said, you say, what they're really talking about is they want a bit more of this. And try to get that in front of them and get that feedback. I think that was really important within that first six 12 months.
So, and what is this emotional need and demand that you're supplying to? I mean, I don't know whether you've actually thought this through. You may not have, but help me out here. What's this emotional need and or demand that you're supplying to? That is the sense of feeling glamorous for a woman at either at work or at an event or whatever it happens to be. Do you have a sense of this, or is it better put to your data people?
No, absolutely. I think our customers tell us all the time, feeling glamorous, so that feeling of happiness. There's a lot of words that come from that, or ways of feeling that are great. There's a sense of confidence. There's a sense of discovering a better version of herself, or being the best version of herself she can be. It's really funny. I think with guys, maybe we're a bit lucky. I think what we wear every day doesn't have as much of an impact on our bearing.
Well, we wear uniforms all the time.
Yeah.
We just wear uniforms.
Yeah.
That's it.
Exactly. And maybe that's what creates our bearing. But I think what we found for our customer is what she wears every day has a big impact on her sense of self, who she identifies as, the confidence she has every day, what she brings to work, her and the people, the interaction she has every day. So glamorous was a really important word to her in terms of its connection to a lot of other things and her overall kind of just happiness and well-being.
So, thereby is born the name Glam Corner. I think it's fantastic. I think it's a great name, particularly when you think of the reason why you're in business, or what is it that you are trying to supply? What emotional thing are you, an emotional fundamental, are you trying to supply to? Because that's where demand comes from. Demand comes from that place in people's minds in a collective. The collective emotions that everybody has a demand for is what you supply, as opposed to we're in the rag trade, we're in the garment leasing business.
Yep.
Because that doesn't tell me anything. And that's great. I think our audience, our listeners must think about this stuff really deeply, because it's so important. It doesn't have to happen day one. As you said, Dean, it evolved over time. And it evolved not by you making the decision, but by people telling you. Mm-hmm. And effectively all you're doing is collecting the data that other people are telling you during that process, and then all you did was articulate it. You just put a sentence under it as to what the data told you. Yeah. Big mistake a lot of people make is they say, everybody needs this, and they go out and tell everybody what they need. And a lot of times these businesses fail. And I think that's a great, great thing you guys have done. It's fantastic. The second thing that is really important, well, I wanted to revisit this, is this sense of affection. You said to me earlier on that people loved your business, loved the feeling they got out of it. Mm. Talk to me about affection. How important is affection in terms of building Glam Corner?
Yeah, I think similar to, sorry, let me go back to, affection for our customer is partially related to removing the burden of ownership that she currently has. So it's about removing a negative as much as it is creating a positive. We know that our customer is actually, I guess, to a certain point in her life, where her wardrobe gets so full of clothes, especially with a trend of cheap disposable clothing.
Yeah, totally. Look at all these retailers now sell stuff at $30, $40.
Yeah, $5.
Yeah, like what's that one called? What's a big one called? They're in Australia now, Zara. Mm-hmm. You can go and buy stuff for like a tenth the price you can buy in all the glamorous joints.
Yeah.
And I think the basis, the fundamental basis for that business is that you wear it a few times, it doesn't matter if you lose it or, give it away or whatever.
That's right. And I think the reason why those international businesses have grown so much in Australia is at least they solve a need for having a fresh new look for a really cheap price. I think that's just that customer responding to that need in her life. The problem is, though, it creates a real hangover in her life that her wardrobe is crammed full of stuff that she never uses, and starts to feel a sense of frustration or even, you know, a degree of stress in her life about that, particularly the impact that she's having on the environment. Our customer has learnt more and more that, you know, basically, Australians throw away 6 tons of clothing every 10 minutes.
I know, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, and it's a huge amount of waste. It's
and like these organisations I just talked about, I'm not going to put shit on them, but like they're part of it.
Absolutely. I mean,
they're producing stuff that just gets dumped.
Absolutely. And the end customer is figuring that out. And with the degree, they feel a bit guilty about it. In the same way you feel guilty about throwing away good food.
So therefore you don't throw it away, you keep it in your wardrobe, and it just clogs up your wardrobe. And the way people live today is they live in smaller apartments, and apartments are built smaller with smaller amount of storage. And every time they move, because a lot of these individuals are, you know, moving from, you know, every 12 months or every 18 months or whatever it is, and they've got to move a whole lot of shit they don't even wear. But they feel too guilty to throw it away.
Exactly. And that creates this huge stress in her
life. I got fucking t-shirts like that, man. I got a wardrobe full of t-shirts. Yeah. And I keep looking and thinking, I'm going to throw that shit away.
Yep.
But I don't want to because I feel like I'm being wasteful.
Yep. Oh, exactly. And that's how our customer feels as well, at a huge scale, and it builds up. So what's really interesting is in the last few years, we've seen a huge trend of decluttering your life. And someone like Marie Kondo has coined a term, you know, spark joy in your life by decluttering all those things that you have this burden of ownership on, from clothing to furniture to you name it. So that has created an affection, as in we've solved that for that customer, and they feel like thank you.
They're relieved.
They feel relieved, exactly.
And you take the guilt away too. So I think that's really important. If you can eliminate some form of guilt in terms of transactions from people, I think that's really important, because guilt can be burdensome. You know, and what I mean by guilt is, wow, if I throw it away, I'm going to cause a problem for the environment. Wow, I've paid money for that. I can't just ditch it. We grew up in this guilt environment, which is fair enough too, by the way, you know, or I worked really hard. I had to spend work for 2 weeks to buy that item. Mm. You know, like that's like 1/26th of your year. Yeah. And that's like 5% of your year, your working life for the year. That's mad. Like you can't throw away something. I think that guilt piece is really good. I mean, I really like that. And I wonder whether or not you're, data now, because I imagine your data is fairly sophisticated these days. You can dig in and really do great analysis. Mm. Does the data stack up around all these concepts that we're talking about?
Absolutely.
Yep.
So we have a lot of data. So from our own site, behavioural data, from clicks to amount of time spent on the site, right through to open source data that's available publicly. Like we could tell you who are the top 40 labels in Australia by search volume. I mean, you know, we know that. We've done it for some time. What does stack up is we know that if our average item, because it's designer made, it's very high quality, and we clinically clean it between wears to good as new, our average item gets rented about 20 times before it's no longer as good as new. So arguably, that's 19 other times it never had to get manufactured in the first place. There's 19 other items didn't have to get manufactured to solve the same amount of demand. That's a 95% reduction in the inputs required to satisfy the same amount of demand, consuming the same thing at the end. And so at a big level, macro level, those numbers stack up. And at a micro level, finding the right product, earning as a renting business, earning a really healthy multiple on our money in 12, 18 months. The margins stack up better than online retail because asset leasing businesses, providing you know how to finance the working capital, the margins can be really good. So the data has been stacking up quite well for us on that side of things.
And you make good money out of the residual too. So, I mean, that's where a lot of rental people make most of that. But the residual being after you've recovered your costs. Whatever you get back after that is just clean profit.
Yep.
I mean, so the game here is buying and buying quality things that last longer, things that are going to last longer, not only in a physical sense in terms of being washed and cared for, but also buying things that in a fashion sense last longer. So how do you solve all that shit?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the residual, I think you're right. What's so interesting about us is these are products that are designer boutique grade. within a few months, they sell out. They're gone. Couldn't buy them if you tried.
You mean at the shop?
Yeah, at the retail level. Like, they're gone. So we find you put them back out in the market 18 months later and they disappear. There's certain labels that people, there's special Facebook groups of people who stick together to just swap and buy, sell a particular label. So we find that residual, disappears quite quickly. And so that's never been a problem for us so far. The really interesting thing on the data side is this kind of trend machine. I think especially that fast fashion has manufactured, that there's a new trend or a new color, a new style every month.
Is that right?
No. We have a lot of data show. It's definitely not the case. Right. We have certain products, styles, labels.
Classics. Are you going to say, is that what you're going to say? Classics as opposed to fashion?
No, exactly. Well, there's evergreen styles, yes, that are always in vogue. I mean, white, a black floor-length ball gown.
Black, yeah.
They're busy all year round.
Yeah.
But there's certain styles that were a hot item 6-12 months ago, but that we see are popular at the same time every year, 3 years in a row. But they were the hot item. What's interesting is we collect that data because we hold on to the products for long enough. We share that with the labels too, because sometimes there's real pressure on designer labels to create something new and not reinvent what you made last season, because that's not cool. It actually creates a lot of waste because there's a lot of guesswork there and they have to really just try a lot of things and see what sticks.
And risk.
And a huge amount of risk for them, which is why they're really happy when we can share back with them some data to at least kind of narrow the field a little.
What do you get back for that? Do you get some sort of discount? I mean, do they look after you guys?
We buy a lot now, so we get pretty good wholesale
pricing. So what would you buy in a year? Like, I mean, maybe a year's not the right thing, but like in the season?
Our open to buy this year is in the multi-millions. Yeah. We from some labels, we're buying in certain drops, hundreds of thousands per drop.
So would you buy were you sort of going to buy 500 of a particular item?
It's funny. We actually end up having to buy a little bit less. So we buy, in certain styles, we'll buy in the dozens, but for certain labels, we'll buy, hundreds of items from them every season.
And did you buy retail? I mean, where do you buy? I mean, I don't know. Where do you buy the stuff from?
We buy it wholesale. 90% of what we buy wholesale.
Right.
We buy retail or clearance retail.
So you don't buy from Dave Jones?
No, sometimes we do tactically, and that's fine. I mean, we're like any other customer there. More throughout the season, if we find we've run out of something or something's been damaged, we'll buy retail if we don't want to let the customer down, but somehow the item's got lost in the mail. We'll go buy it for her and get it to her. So we buy 90% wholesale from the labels like everyone else.
And the labels, what does it mean?
Oh, from the designer brands.
Right.
So, there's especially the Australian designer fashion scene really punches above its weight.
Does it?
Globally. Fantastic names like Rebecca Valance, Alice McCall, Camilla Franks, Alex Perry. Like, these names have been around and are international names, building fantastic world-grade designer product here, locally, in Australia. And so we buy direct from these people because it's taken us a few years to show this to a few of the bigger names, but we're creating an incremental revenue opportunity for their brand. Because our customer was never shopping Alice McCall at David Jones for $600. Mm. She was going to Topshop for $60. So our customer is in that price point. So suddenly we make their brand relevant at that price point. On a rental basis, you don't get to own the brand. But for this customer, she's less attached to ownership anyway.
So how do you work out your price? So I think that's important. Like, how do you work out the price at which you what's the market demand? How do you work out the price for demand?
Yeah, it's got to be, first of all, a reference point to where would it be if you bought it retail? If you rent a car
Let's say $1,000.
Yeah, so if you could buy it retail $1,000, you can rent it from us for about 100, 150.
Is it a formula?
Yeah, so about 10, we target 10, 15% of the retail price.
Right.
If we can buy it wholesale for 500, after about 3 rentals, we've earned our capital back. Sometimes that takes about 90 days. Sometimes that takes 3 days.
Right.
So we've gotten good at identifying that stuff early.
And how are you doing that when you say you've gotten good at it? Is it just data science?
A bit of, data science, just some plain just financial discipline around getting the information faster to go, is this asset hemorrhaging money or is it paying for itself?
But are you small enough still to sit down and make that sort of decision, or is it someone in your business makes that decision?
We have team members now. So we have an internal accountant, we have a data science team, we have software engineers. We have about 60 people on the payroll now.
Yep.
It was me though. Like the formula, especially on that side of things, was me.
Yep.
Early on, there was no one else who would have a degree of paranoia around, is this stuff making its money back fast enough? Yeah. You find out pretty fast if it isn't. You know, but in the end, it was, which was great. The early days of how we did our asset utilization analysis, we then built our software engineering team to build databases around it. We built a business intelligence tool on top of it that can create nice dashboards for the merchandising team, for the marketing team. So suddenly we make sure the best products get in front of customers faster and are being priced. That's the next stage for us, is actually pricing mechanics, because rental, it's kind of like hotel rooms and flight bookings. You can adjust the price a little.
Yeah.
For us, if something is really popular and we don't have enough of it, the price will just gravitate up a little because it's just supply and demand.
Uber style.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. So do you make suggestions then? Does your website know that Mary down the road likes to wear long red dresses made out of satin or something? And then you just start to offer her suggestions.
It does.
Yep.
They're not as sophisticated as we'd like them to be yet. So we've got a machine learning programmer now doing really basic machine learning programming, getting the data stack right so the data quality is good enough to do good quality machine learning. And machine learning can be really basic formulas too. It doesn't have to be formulas, you know, this long. Because in the end, it's not about doing machine learning because it's cool. We want to do machine learning because if we can get what our customer is looking for in front of her faster, that's better for her.
Mm.
We want to be better at saying this. You know, a lot of people who are, you know, your size, who live, you know, in your postcode, our customers have to give their postcode because it affects shipping times and availability, but it also helps us just understand our demographic trends a bit better. So our website does recommend products based on customers' behavior.
You do it through your social too, that?
There's retargeting through social, yes.
Yep. We're going to run a short time here, Dan, which is a punish, but I do want to talk about your social.
Mm-hmm.
So, because obviously brand building is not only about affection, it's about notoriety. Clearly, you all got a lot of referral work. I mean, people would be telling their mate about this and et cetera.
Yeah.
But what do you guys do in terms of social?
So it's funny, especially about the referral piece. When we talk about social media, we're not just talking about Instagram and Facebook. Social commerce can come in a lot of forms. Early on, we introduced a refer a friend engine. So if you refer a friend and gift them with $20 of store credit for their first booking, if they make that booking, you get $20 of store credit. That still comprises like 5% of sales for us years on. We did a little bit of work on it, and it's they're 5% incremental, but 5 to 10% of sales is coming from people who've been referred from a friend who's already a customer. And that just keeps building. It hasn't stopped in 3 years. So there's that side of social commerce, trying to enable our customers to be our biggest fans. And in terms of the rest of our social media, our focus is actually always try to be on our customers. We've never tried to be about, look at us, look how smart we are, look how good we are building this business. We've always tried to put our customers front and center and say, let them tell other people about why they use our service, why this is great for them. On our YouTube, actually, we recently did a series interviewing our customers, asking them exactly that question.
The real life stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what we found was...
And how long does a YouTube episode go for?
It varies, probably between 2 to 3 minutes, up to some of them 10 minutes.
Okay, for those people listening, I mean, you've got to be careful with YouTube. You don't want to make it too long because people will just clock out.
But, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so 2 to 3 minutes is your sweet spot.
2 to 3 minutes is pretty good.
Yep.
It's funny, you get a huge amount of engagement for like the 10-second videos. Then it kind of drops off to this valley to 2 or 3 minutes. And then it drops off again. There's some people who do like.
It's right out.
Yeah, there's some people who like to watch for 10 minutes, but it's not everybody.
Not many.
Yeah.
Not many, but a few. But still, you still need to have that in your suite because, you know, you don't lose anybody if you can hold them. And what you've got to do is make sure you've got to deliver to those who like to listen to 10 seconds.
Mm.
You've got to give them exactly what they want in the 10 seconds as well.
It's
a bit of an art. So your marketing program is Instagram, Facebook, referral systems, your website, obviously, YouTube.
Yep.
So you're pretty much using everything.
Yep. Actually, the biggest one is search. I think people shouldn't underestimate search.
Yep.
Social is really important for building a community.
Yep.
And having that relationship with your customers. It wouldn't be true to say we've built our business on social media because it's been a part of it. But a big part has been search, where we're stocking a lot of very high quality designer brands that a lot of people are looking for. And if you stock a lot of good quality merchandise and you do best practice search engine optimization.
So you're saying, what we're talking about here for those people listening is I want to hire a Zara dress. I'm the only bloody brand I know, so sorry, I keep saying Zara. I'm not here to promote Zara, that's for sure. Rent a Zara dress.
Yep.
Is that right?
Or even just searching for the brand. So if our customer was searching for this particular brand, who she saw on social media and really aspires to wear, she will discover in searching that, yes, you can buy it, but it's also available for rent. That's really powerful for us in terms of...
And you want to be the place I land on.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that's where web is good for discovery.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Having an app is great for retention and all that, but for discovery, it's really hard to beat Google on what they can deliver on that. So I would never underestimate that.
Yeah, 100%, 100%.
Yep.
And we've got the wind-up. So what that means is I've asked enough questions and usually I have the opportunity... usually I give you the opportunity to ask me one question. So maybe it sounds like you've got your shit together here, mate. So you probably don't have a question for me, but what one question would you ask me? And I do note here, but I think our listeners got to note that you have gone through capital raising and you have the Etree Ventures guys in there. So anyway, what's your one question? Because I just want to go back. I mean, you haven't done this all on your own in more recent years because, every business needs capital and I'm sure the Etree Ventures guys are very happy with this and they're one of our big VC, investors in this country. Mm. What's your one question, Dean?
Sure thing. I'll also say, the Etree guys have been great business partner. And if for anyone out there, for what it's worth, if you need the external capital and you got a strategic opportunity and you need to strike and you just want to win, sometimes bringing in the right business partner with the right connections and capital can help you get there faster because it's that window may be only open for so long.
And don't sit around thinking, I've got to give away 20%, or I've got to give away 25%, it's too much, et cetera, because that might be the last opportunity you ever get.
Exactly.
Because they're looking at hundreds of deals every week.
That's right. I mean, since the Etree guys came in, our business is 60 to 70 times the size it was. So right. I think that was a good business decision that we made.
Yeah. How'd you meet the Etree Ventures guys?
I met them, I think...
Was it a pitch day?
Maybe it was a pitch day, or I think I came across Craig. I think someone had, I think when I was working in finance, a headhunter who always said to me, hey, these people are recruiting, said, hey, these guys are recruiting, maybe worth a chat. And because we had a startup, I wanted to meet Craig. I think I said as a job interview, but really I just wanted to meet him to get us on their radar. And that's when I don't think he was interested in meeting
Candidate. Well, they're a great partner because they're sitting behind the likes of companies like Prosper, et cetera, at the moment, which are looking at massive, massively big market capitalization businesses. So what's your one question, mate?
Exactly, mate. The question I got is, and I thought about this a lot because I've only got one shot to ask you, it would be when it comes to people, I think we've had a lot of success and that's been great. It still gets very difficult when it comes to hiring the right people. When I look at some big failures we've made over the last few years, a lot of the ones that really stand out for me is hiring the wrong people that, hurt us or set us back in some way. I think we're very lucky we've been growing so much. Maybe it falls out in the wash, you don't notice, but it's there. I feel like when we've hired the wrong people, even though we've taken the right advice of hire slow, take the time to check they're going to be a cultural fit, etc., you do all those things, you tick all those boxes, and someone starts in a role, and maybe first month really starts to nail it, but within 3 months you realise it's not working. You try to adjust it, try to calibrate it, and then 6 months later you've got to make a difficult decision. My question is, what have you found, have you built a better intuition for, what are the signals for you where you realise I'm not doing myself or this person any favours to perhaps say maybe this role isn't working out and call it sooner? Because I always find we've taken too long to do it.
Yeah, well, it's no secret in my businesses, and I've often been criticised in the media for this, through the media, people haven't lasted with me. And of course, I ran that TV show called The Apprentice, where I was actually telling people they were fired. So it is intuition based from my point of view. And I've often thought to myself, there's a business in this, and that somebody could start building algorithms whereby someone like you could plot within the algorithm all the various inputs and probably come out with an answer about somebody over time. Mm. But for me, at the end of the day, it's just my intuition. Businesses grow faster and beyond individuals a lot. For me, it's kill fast. So if I have to get rid of somebody, I kill them fast. Mm-hmm. It's better. I just front up, tell them, look, it's not working out. You got to move on. And that sounds really cold-hearted and it sounds like an episode of The Apprentice. It's not. It's a reality. You've got to do it. I mean, whether it's in politics or whether it's in business, big businesses or small businesses, the same thing exists. I don't believe in the loyalty card. I just don't believe in it. Today, businesses, especially new businesses, move so fast that you can't be sitting there with the wrong person in the role because you'll end up having sometimes monumental errors. The business will suffer monumentally. So business, if business moves fast, if systems move fast, your intuition has to be equally as fast in terms of the way you respond to how you feel about somebody. And I think still believe that that feeling, which has never been put into some sort of machine learning, your intuition is the most powerful thing, and you just listen to it and do it quick. See, your business, where it started from and where it evolves to within a six-month period, is vastly different to where it was 6 months ago. And the individual you chose 6 months ago, unless he or she grows with the business in the same way, and I don't mean grow in terms of work time they can work, but in terms of the thing that they can offer to the business. And what they got offered to the business is what the business demands. It's not what, oh, we know this person's a really great finance person, or this person's got 25 years experience in this industry. It's largely irrelevant. It's what the business is demanding at the time, irrespective of their experience, irrespective of how nice a person they are, irrespective of the loyalty they've showed you. You've got to just get the right person for what the business demands at the time. And unfortunately, you just got to nail them if they're not the right person.
Yep.
And I do it. I do it all the time. I get criticised about it. And people still keep saying to me, you keep changing your mind. You just cop it on the chin. Because at the end of the day, you've got to do the right thing by your shareholders and your customers and ultimately yourself. And by the way, if you kill it quick, you're doing the right thing by the person that you've done it to. So I always get sit in and give an opportunity. It's not a warning or a performance review. It's not that. I just sit and have a frank conversation. I say, look, the business is where the business is going. This is what the business demands. Can you do it? And if you can't, tell me now. But like in 1 month's time, if I don't feel as though you're doing it, you're going to have to go.
Yep.
Straight up. There's nothing personal, no reflection on the individual. It's a tough call. It's a big decision, but it's an important one.
Thanks, Mark. That definitely answered that for me, mate.
Good on you, Dean. Good to see you, mate.
You too, mate.
And I hope Audrey gets better really quickly.
Me too. We can't live without her.
See you, mate. Thanks so much.
Cheers.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.